Good evening and welcome to this event at the Quantum to Cosmos Festival. My name is Neil Turok and I'm the lucky guy who is the director of Perimeter Institute. I want to welcome everyone here in this packed auditorium and everyone watching online in Waterloo, Ontario and the world. Before we begin the event, can I please ask you, those of you in the theater, to turn your BlackBerries and phones off, and those of you online to please email all your friends and tell them this event is happening and they can watch it in high definition live, which is, as far as I know, a first made possible at this festival. So the website is q2cfestival.com. And you can also follow things on Twitter. It's my great privilege and pleasure to introduce Lee Smolin, who will be hosting this session. Lee is one of the visionary people who founded this institute, and certainly in my case, I was very skeptical that it could be done, but they did it. It's a wonderful place. Lee is also well known as an author of popular books. He's written The Life of the Cosmos, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity, and The Trouble with Physics, and right now he's working on a new book called The Reality of Time. He's one of the inventors of the theory of loop quantum gravity, and his research interests are extremely broad, ranging from cosmology, particle theory, economics, and even theoretical biology. So please join me in welcoming Lee Smolin.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you. Well, thank you, but I'm just the moderator, which means my job is really to be an immoderator. And I hope that, good. It is an enormous pleasure to invite here and have a conversation with Neil Stephenson and Jaron Lanier. I cannot think of any two people better suited to have a conversation with about the future of science, the future of technology, and the future of humanity. I'll be very brief because many of you know a great deal about them. Neil Stephenson is an author of 9 novels of fiction and a book of nonfiction. Sometimes he's mischaracterized as a science fiction writer, but he's also written historical fiction, The Baroque Cycle, for example, the best treatment I know, a little bit fictionalized, is true of the Royal Society and the scientists Newton, Leibniz, Huygens, Hooke, and so many others. His last book, Anathem, is an examination from a novelistic perspective of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, and I should say is the only thing I ever read in any venue that made me think quite possibly that was worth taking seriously. Apologies to Chris if he's here. He has won many awards. He is arguably the most influential writer of books about science, let me put it that way, of our generation. And it's a great pleasure to welcome him here. Jaron Lanier is not easy. Wow. That's me. It's when I ever lean this way. Jaron is not easy to characterize. Jaron is, among other things, a composer of classical music and has had a long list of commissions, operas, ballets, symphonies. He has his own group. He has been Ebony's new Black Musician of the Month or Black Jazz Musician of the Month. He has. Okay. They can't tell, right. Right. Jaron is a computer scientist and a visionary of the computer world. He coined the term virtual reality and made the first implementation of the technology of virtual reality. He has made many other visionary contributions to computer science, applications of virtual reality, tele-immersion, and many things like this. He is both scholar for interdisciplinary blah, blah, blah at Berkeley, and he recently took his first actual job, which is with Microsoft Corporation. Jaron is also a gifted writer. Ian McEwan, the British novelist, calls him his favorite essayist of our generation, or living essayist. And Jaron has a book, You Are Not a Gadget, which has been in preparation for many, many years and coming out from Knopf in January and is sure to be controversial. Now, it's especially a pleasure to have a conversation with Neil and Jaron because you guys have known each other for a very long time and been talking for a long time. Do you remember when you met?
I do not.
I think you showed up at my house under some pretenses.
See, I thought you showed up. I think you showed up at my lab, wanting a demo.
No.
Well, maybe in some parallel world. Now, one of the dangerous themes that Neil touched on in his recent novel is the notion of parallel universes, a very nervous thing for us physicists to talk about. How did you come to write about parallel universes?
Well, when I was a kid and a heavy reader of science fiction books, sort of golden age of science fiction type science fiction books, the ones that I always found most intriguing were the ones that involved parallel universes in some way. So I can remember specific images from these books. There's an Asimov book where, I can't remember which one it is, somebody here probably knows, but someone inadvertently passes through a gate into a parallel world and sort of falls down and he's looking at himself and dusting himself off and he notices that the end of the heel of his shoe is missing. It's been cleanly sheared off and sort of a mirror perfect finish. And he reckons that when he was passing through the portal between the universes, it happened to close off just after he went through and it sheared off the end of his heel and left it back in the home universe. So I was always fascinated by those kinds of ideas and those images. And the sort of traditional explanation that tended to be given was in the kind of fake physics that we science fiction writers use, was that there were other three-dimensional universes that were very close to ours, separated by a very small amount of distance in a fourth spatial dimension that we're oblivious to. And if you could just move a fraction of an inch in along that fourth spatial dimension, you'd end up in another three-dimensional universe a little bit different from ours. So one of the ambitions I had always harbored was to eventually write a science fiction novel that had parallel universes in it, and I wanted to have a completely different and new kind of hand-wavy, fake, bogus physics to explain my concept of parallel universes. And so, of course, all of our fictional hand-wavy fake physics tends to be based on real physics at some level. So that's how I started getting fascinated by the world of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics and phase space, configuration space, and so on.
But when you prepared writing about this, are there physicists that you read? Are there that were particularly inspirations or anti-inspirations?
Julian Barber, who's sitting 10 feet away, the discovery of dynamics, the end of time, the whole way of thinking about about physics that sees universes as tracks in a configuration space that's shared by all possible universes. David Deutsch, The Fabric of Reality. I would say those are the two whose work bore most directly on.
So you see, Julian, somebody reads these books. that's good to know. Now, does the fact that you, in the book, so I really have to say I hate the Many Worlds Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics, but I loved that book. have you studied the problem? Do you advocate the Many Worlds Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics?
Well, I'm not confident to advocate it or not advocate it. But
we're among friends here.
But I will say that I hated it too until I read Deutsch's book, which I thought made it easier to believe than any other treatment of the idea that I had seen before. So that came along for me at an opportune time. It had already been around for a number of years at the time I was writing the book, and it's sitting on my table, one of those books I should get around to reading, and I never did, but I finally picked it up at sort of just the right moment.
So while we're talking about the interpretations of quantum mechanics, Jaron, you have a view of the interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Wait, do I? I don't recall having one. What are you thinking of?
Well, the Many Worlds Interpretation.
Well, I can think of a couple of things about the many. I've written a little bit about Many Worlds, but nothing we've talked about before. I remember a couple of years ago, there was an interesting kerfluffle where somebody came up with a novel proof of God using virtual reality, and then I used Many Worlds to refute it. That was kind of fun.
So how did this make you feel when your invention, virtual reality, was used to prove the existence of God? Was that a good thing?
No, one feels violated, but this...
do you remember
but
the
this
proof?
Happens. This happens, you know, with all... Yeah, well, so what the story was is, let's suppose that you have a godless universe and civilizations evolve, and eventually they'll want to make virtual reality because it's wonderfully cool, which I accept that as a premise, and then the virtual reality will become so good that the little creatures inside it will become conscious. And because there's only one natural reality and then all these virtual worlds, there's a very strong statistical likelihood that anybody who suddenly experiences themselves being conscious is inside a virtual world, and therefore there was a God who made that world, and we must be those creatures.
Well, this is a paper in physics.
This might have been, yeah.
And so then we heard that talk here. We're not going to mention by
and
who.
So anyway, I don't even remember the names of the people involved. So I published a tongue-in-cheek refutation, which is pointing out, well, you know, in the quantum computation world, we end up thinking in terms of the many worlds interpretation just as a practical matter. Completely aside from whether, you know, one likes it or not, it is the convenient way to think about quantum communications and in many cases and computation. And so if there are a potentially unbounded number of base universes, then you can't really compare the number of base universes to virtual realities within them anymore. So suddenly the argument goes away and there goes God, you see. So that's the refutation. So do you follow? It's straightforward. You can't compare infinities, you know, basic okay. stuff. So anyway, so you can use the many worlds to refute the virtual reality proof of God. So it has utility. See, that's the thing.
So this messes up completely the discussions of the anthropic principle and people counting possible universes.
Oh,
we didn't have
stuff.
A talk
I'm
about
sorry.
God.
I know what
yeah,
you,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But we did
yeah,
have
yeah.
a talk here about how virtual reality affects what's called the measure of the wave function of
right.
the universe.
Right.
Yeah. But right. but Jaron, when you made virtual reality, when you invented mm-hmm. the idea, was your object to be able to make a simulation so good that you could be fooled?
No, only so others could be fooled.
And did you succeed?
Clearly. I mean, look, you know.
Everyone here except you thinks that this is real.
Okay. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's how it works. No, actually, I mean, the origins of virtuality are actually a little more interesting in that, you know, in that this question of how the nervous system starts to believe in the outside world is a very interesting one. And we're little exploratory experimental prediction machines where our bodies and our minds are constantly probing the environment and performing. Unintentional scientists at every moment predicting what the world's about to be like, and we're creating this wonderful synchronization between our interior sense of the world and the world itself as we measure it at every moment, and it's a marvelous process. And building a machine that intervenes in that is a way to study it. So that was the origin of it. And then aside from that, it's a beautiful medium. Of course, you know, I've been asked for 30 years, you know, will it ever be so good that you can't tell? And my answer has been for 30 years that as you experience virtuality, your own acuity improves because of the practice you get, so you actually stay ahead of the technology. So the virtuality of 50 years from now might fool us, but the people who will be experiencing it in 50 years will be more savvy than us and will not be fooled. So that's the actual answer.
Did that happen with recording of music? For example.
Say it again?
With digital recording of music, did that happen?
Sure. I mean, people can tell the difference between MP3s and CDs now, and I don't think they could have 25 years ago. I think we learned from experience.
Now, Neil, one of your earlier novels was about virtual reality. I don't remember which one, but you'll probably remember.
Snow Crash.
Snow Crash.
Yeah.
So what were you interested in?
Well, at the time, I mean, how did that come about? I had been fooling around with graphics. I used to program as a hobby, and maybe one day I'll start doing it again. I had been messing around with graphics on a Macintosh 2. And it wasn't fast enough, and so I had gotten an add-on thing called a transputer board, which was a board you could jack into one of the slots that had a bunch of little parallel processors on it to make things go faster. And they were doing a demo to show how fast and how cool this thing was. They had a demo showing. It was a ray tracing demo showing a bunch of reflecting spheres floating around, I think. So that kind of got me thinking about the idea of using computers to create, you know, simulations of 3D reality. But it was painfully obvious to me that at that point anyway, it was hideously expensive. And so I was trying to think of how could you bring the price down? And the answer is that you can make anything cheap if you create large enough quantities of it. And so, in order to have that big of a market, it was going to be necessary to create a virtual world that would draw in the largest possible number of people. It would be like television is today. So. Instead of being sort of cool and sophisticated, it was going to be kind of lowest common denominator stuff. And so that was how I came up with the idea for the metaverse, the virtual reality system in Snow Crash. It's not meant to be a noble, high-minded kind of pursuit, but it's meant to reach the largest possible target market.
Fortunately, what actually transpired in Second Life, for instance, has been universally ennobling and has avoided that that fate.
So here's a question. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, here's a question for each of you. I mean, do you think that digital technology is ennobling us, is humanizing us, is changing us?
This is like this lead-in for some like huge rant from me. Is that the notion here?
No, I wanted the rant from Neil.
Okay, good. You rant.
You can rant in a minute.
Ennobling us. Is it ennobling us?
Is it changing us?
Well, it seems to be changing the way that we think, the way that we access information. Nobility is kind of an interesting, you know, term. At the moment, I happen to be rereading Winston Churchill's account of the Second World War, got hooked on that again recently. So there's lots of noble people and not so noble people populating the pages of that book, and they're all doing everything with paper and telegrams and so on. So that's kind of what comes to my mind when I think of things that are ennobling. A lot of times it seems as though the modern world doesn't seem to produce a lot of the kinds of noble seeming people who we see in times of great crisis, like the Second World War or what have you. But before somebody else does it, let me make the counter argument that what we've got now is also a way of preventing the really horrendously bad people from gaining a foothold. Because if you've got anything in your background that makes you look bad, it's going to be on the internet very soon for everyone to see.
So I won't presume everybody's read Anathem, but in Anathem, you create a society which is a society of scientifically or mathematically minded people who are cloistered in the way that religious orders are cloistered.
Mm-hmm.
And we, if I can use the term, are cloistered to protect us from the world, and also the world is protected from us. And in this cloistered world, there is almost no technology. That is, it's blackboard and pencil and paper and growing their own food, and they don't have cell phones, which people outside have. They don't have access to the internet. They don't have, and some of them do aspire to nobility. Some of the characters, there is a historical crisis, and some of them do. And so, is that? Are you trying to tell us something with that story?
I tried to be pretty careful about having some good and bad people on both sides of that cloister wall, so I wouldn't want to suggest that either side has got a handle on noble personal qualities. I don't know what it is that gives a person what we define as nobility. I think you can find it on either side. It's kind of a wishy-washy answer, but
we'll come back actually, because I want to talk about Perimeter in a while as an example of that. But before, I think Jaron does have a rant.
the book that's coming out has my rant in it, but. Just very briefly, I'm a little concerned that things have gone awry with the way digital culture is moving, because there's sort of a set of ideas that have become extremely popular, and it's very uncomfortable to oppose them because they seem to many people to be the sort of heart of coolness and wonderfulness, and the open culture and anti-copyright stuff and the wiki stuff, and it's all fine, and it's not evil or anything, but I think that there's a gradual process where people are sort of erasing themselves and viewing themselves a little polyps in some sort of collective thing. And in history, nothing ever good comes of that. That's like it's a bad direction to go, and I am really concerned that there's a big mistake being made. And I think I can leave it at that for now. But I think Neil might be right that there might be a bit of a prophylactic effect that. Even if the internet does tend to make people cranky and to collect together with their peers in one-sided vain anonymity or whatever, these things that have this sort of strange way that people gather and just become more and more excitable in online worlds and become rude and all of these things. Perhaps there is a prophylactic effect where Hitler would be less likely to come about, and I so hope that's correct. What's interesting is this is the experiment we're undertaking now, and we're going to know the answer in a decade or two.
Do you have a Facebook page?
No, my cat was on Facebook for a while. And you know my cat. Yeah, her name is Loof, because she is not aloof, so she was fine with getting on Facebook, but she dropped it after a while because she was just getting all these nonsense, you know, the connection, so.
So, Jaron, if you are somebody who is creative as a computer scientist, as a composer, as a writer, and so forth, if you had to create your ideal context, your ideal society to work in, what would it be like? How would you?
Well, you know, the vision I still like that was never explored was the original one presented with the very idea of connected media, of links and so forth. The guy who invented the idea of the link was Ted Nelson, who is still with us, still a sort of cranky, difficult guy who I adore, who not his own best advocate, almost impossible to understand, and it's a shame because I think his original idea was really the best idea. Before the web was born, even before the internet was first turned on in its little tiny baby steps, he had been conceiving of something very much like the web, and the way he saw it is everybody would have access to everything, but there would be little micropayments flowing around constantly. So if somebody derived something from your work, they would be able to figure out it was really you, so nothing would be anonymous, and little pennies would flow to you, and more people would find a way to make a living from creativity. And what we have instead is a world where creativity flows around for free because we're all supposed to be part of this, the Creative Commons and so forth, and meanwhile we're told to become more physical in our way of making a living, to really build and sell things, make t-shirts or something. So, you know, technology has been helping us climb up Maslow's pyramid to have more and more enlightened and intellectual and creative ways to make a living, and now suddenly we're climbing back down instead of continuing the climb upward. And I think it's a terrible wrong turn. And so Ted's original idea of sort of just a universal micropayment with attribution, I think is a beautiful notion. And so then everything would be accessible, and it wouldn't be free, but it would be affordable. And I think it's a way to have sort of a society with the liberties of capitalism, but with the equity of socialism in one place, hypothetically. It's never been tried, so you know it might be a horrific thing if it was actually tried, but it seems to me sensible and worthy, and it's a shame we don't really know how well it would work.
Can we get there from where we are now?
I sure am scheming.
But This online connected world, people also have to interact, have to work somewhere, have to be somewhere. So I want to address both of you, but let me come back to Neil's books, because Neil, you have done something very, to me, as a scientist who works inside of the scientific world and who also has been part of inventing this institute. You twice, in two very different contexts, drew portraits of scientists in a constructed environment, in an institution. First, in the Royal Society, the original Royal Society, which you wrote 3,000-something pages about in the three volumes. And then in Anathem, you come back and you present the same question, that is, here's a way for scientists to live. So do you have some advice for us? I mean,
less than 4,000 pages? the Royal Society gang is a really interesting bunch of characters, obviously, in reading about them, I mean, I wrote a lot of material about those guys while leaving out half of them. I mean, I didn't mention Willis or a lot of the other people who could have come into that discussion. So the constellation of minds that came into existence around that group at that time was really strange. And it almost makes one want to look for some kind of mystical explanation for how it could have all have happened at that time. And so in a way...
Did you, by the way, sorry to interrupt, but did you look for a mystical explanation?
Well, there's some, so, yeah, there's, so I talk a little bit of rubbish about Quicksilver, which is a, not just the element of mercury, but it's in alchemical terms, it's a kind of a mystical element that's got both, it embodies certain properties of speed and communication, and liveliness and intelligence, but it's also poisonous. So that's the theme of the first book. It's the title of the first book in the series, and the idea is that there was just a lot of it sloshing around at that point. So that's the closest I come to a mystical explanation. And you can only do that in fiction. Right. If I were to write a work of fiction about the creation of a scientific club and put together even two of those people in the same place at the same time, everybody would denounce the book as rubbish. It's completely impossible that you could have any two such people, you know, living in the same place and actually knowing each other. So, you know, as the adage goes, truth is stranger than fiction. And so if you really want to write truly weird material, you've got to base it in history, because you can get away with having it be as weird as history really was. In the case of Anathem, it's a much more kind of institutional view of how these entities came about. It's just The society makes a decision that all of the literate book reading people are going to be cloistered, and then we jump ahead 3,000 years and see what the result of that decision has been. But there's not a lot of attention paid in that book to specific people doing historical scientists or what have you, having done specific work, because It's just too difficult to invent a fictional scientist and a fictional scientific theory that the fictional scientist comes up with that actually makes sense, and to explain why
you
this.
Got lots of them. You just spend just spending a few days here.
Yeah.
But
would all the scientists who are fictional raise their hands, please?
But you know, there's we're at this moment we're part of a sort of opposite thing. So the view that we have taken here at Perimeter, although you might not always know it from the architecture, so for some reason there's that black wall with the cryptic design of the windows there. But don't pay any attention to that. We know what image that gives people. I mean, we have the sense. So in Neil's novel, the doors to the analog of Perimeter Institute open just once a year for 10 days, and then the more serious scientists are in another place where that door only opens once every 10 years. And then if you're really good, like you get tenure, you go into a place where the door only opens once every 100 years. And roughly speaking, but we here have the idea in the contemporary world of opening the doors as much as possible and bringing people in. So we're not following your advice. but maybe when we come to the question session, we can see if people think we should be behind a wall, we'll take it into.
Well, the ambiguity that's working with is that scientists need to be left alone and to do long attention span work. And so, in a sense, it's good for them to be in a quiet place without a lot of distractions. And non-scientists sometimes have kind of a rocky relationship with scientists and come to kind of dislike them and fear them, need them, but don't like some of the implications of some of the things that are rattling around in their heads. And so the decision that's been made in this fictional world is that there's been a kind of separation of the two groups. It kind of gives the scientists what they want, and that they get left alone, and it kind of gives the non-scientists what they want, which is no more scientists, except when they need them. Because there is a mechanism that the outside world, the secular world, so-called, can use to reach in and pull out a couple of these people when they need a cure for cancer, or, you know, a new, a faster cell phone. Or
now we can make an experiment here.
Okay.
About how scientists make it. So we have somebody here who is both a scientist and a musician. Do you ever only tell people about one side because you don't want to make them nervous? If you walk into a bar and you're...
I never walk into bars, but
You know what I'm saying? Do you ever do the musician thing because it's friendlier?
I guess. I mean, I think there's a problem that might be more U.S. specific of a sort of anti-intellectualism that the nerds don't get the girls and all that. And it was starting to break down a little bit in recent, because of the rise of the internet and the coolness of digital tech. And I've noticed it's sort of it's getting bad again. That there's a popular TV show where the scientists are all evil and so forth. And there's this it's a problem. And the thing is that stupidity self-propagates, right? It benefits the more of itself that there is around in its environment. It feeds on itself. And so there's a sort of vortex of anti-intellectualism in America that is associated with our other problems that is really annoying. And I wish I knew some way to make it suddenly disappear.
It's very old. So,
yeah, it is. It is. As are many of our problems, they come from our origins. But what I wanted to say about this question of how open or closed an institution might be is that I think there is a benefit to having encapsulation around intellectual activity. That doesn't mean that people have to be utterly cloistered, but the notion that everything should be opened and mixed all the time is not good, because then you can't nurture something well enough to really understand it. And I think that's a sort of a mistake that's going on in the internet. There's this notion that creativity always happens when everything is as open as possible. And in fact, periodic openness and closeness is probably the better formula. The analogy I like is in nature, that there was a time before cells existed and genes just kind of mixed, but once you have a cell, then there's that one organism that's somewhat cloistered and performs a complicated experiment on its own combination of genes so that it can get a more high-level answer than could possibly come about from a general mush. And I think it's important for us to do that in our own intellectual structures, too.
But then cells also, from time to time, can incorporate genetic material that they find floating around.
If you're too extreme in either direction, it breaks. But that's what I'm saying. If it's periodic, if there's a punctuated cloisteredness, which you had, in fact. But for instance, if you're working on a paper, you might keep it secret for a while so your team can really understand it before you actually get it to reviewers and it's published. So there's this sort of punctuation where you're like a cell for a while, and then you open, and then you're like a cell for a while again. And I think that rhythm of being temporarily closed so you can gather enough ideas in one place to really understand them, really nurture them, really test them, is extremely important. And that doesn't happen if things are too open.
So let's talk a little science. So we've been talking about how science is done.
Okay.
One of the things that we do here is quantum information and quantum computing. I know that both of you have thought about. So do either of you have a vision of since you've both written a lot about the impact of digital technology on the world, you know, can you dream a little bit? What will be the impact of quantum computation on the world if it happens?
Wow.
Will it happen?
You know, I think the jury is still out. I think we're going to know so much more just in a few years, because there's some really good experiments going on now. There are a couple of people who have claimed to have really good demos of substantial quantum systems that I've seen that, you know, you actually can't tell just yet, because they're so marginal. The effects are so marginal. I mean, of course, for trivial ones, but for substantial ones where it really starts to make a difference to do something that couldn't be done otherwise. I mean, hypothetically, if you could build giant, reliable quantum machines, you could, I mean, that's extraordinary because then you have, if you think of the computation itself as a physical effect, you gain a sort of a detailed, textured access to reality that could probably reveal all sorts of things. I mean, I think that's a fundamental new page. I think we'll learn surprising things. I mean, if that can happen at all, I'm sure there'll be extraordinary surprises.
Neil?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, we've got incredibly fast, powerful computers now that we could not dream of. You know, when I started programming computers, still, you know, writing software is a problem, right? I mean, you can have great hardware, but it's only as useful as the software that you have got running on it. And so I think there's, you know, it would be nice to have that incredibly high-powered quantum hardware, but I don't know. Don't know if anyone has a grip right now on what we would do with it. If someone came in from the future in a time machine and handed us a quantum computer now that actually worked, you know, where's the operating system for that? What's the programming language? What's the input and output for it? What actually do you do with it?
No, I have, you know, many dreams and speculations about the answers to those questions, but I think that those are exactly the right questions. And in the case of conventional computers, Turing von Neumann-derived machines that we use every day, the truth is we still don't know how to write software for them. We struggle just to get what are really pretty basic things to happen. Like, I mean, people are delighted if the iPhone gets cut, copy, paste after a few years or something like that. And you have to, really, that's not a jibe at Apple. It's just the state of computer science. It's just that actually is how hard it is to do pathetically simple things because we actually don't know how to write software. So that's clearly the more important problem to solve. And it's a really hard one.
Can you state, so both of you have mentioned this problem with software. Can you state more precisely, what is the problem with, why is software not getting better? That's what I hear you saying, Neil, and I hear Jared saying the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it is limitations on interface. I mean, to use the iPhone example, it's just, half the time I can't get it to recognize that I'm a human. I have to lick my fingers, especially when it gets cold. So there's only so much you can do when you're kind of, you
know. That's the Turing test, right? If it recognizes that you're human, then it.
Yeah.
Well.
No. It can't see my flesh.
But the interface is the only part of it that's real. I mean, that's the empirical evidence that it's doing computation. I mean, that's the only thing that matters. So I can tell you my theory about why software's hard. It's very simple. It's that right now, if you change a bit in software, it correlates in a formally random way to the resulting change in behavior in the program when it runs. So if you change a bit, the program might crash, it might be exactly the same. And so there's absolutely zero signal in the feedback loop of how a change to software affects the behavior of software, and so therefore there can be no adaptation and you're always back to square one. And so any kind of software that can improve will have to have some sort of statistical basis where there's some signal-to-noise ratio in the feedback loop between changing the software and observing its behavior, and then you can treat it like engineering or science, and you can actually make progress. But the way we're doing it right now, you cannot, and it's just hopeless. And there are other ways to say the same idea. Gregory Chaitin has some very nice ways to say something similar, but it's just hard.
So let me ask a question of all three of us this way. So each of the three of us spend some of our time writing. I mean, you, Neil, the most, as far as I could guess. At least it must have taken some time to write all those thousands of pages. But we all spend a lot of time writing, and writing is something that people have been doing for thousands and thousands of years, more or less the same way. I mean, maybe now, I don't know if you two write by hand or write on a computer or whatever, but
we're doing the same thing that people were doing 3,000 years ago, roughly speaking. We're telling stories through composing sentences and so forth. And this evolves and there's progress of some kinds, but there's something about the activity which is very fundamental to being human. And one could say that about other things. One can say that about music. One can say that about art. One can say that in a certain sense about science. I mean, with the science, the frontier is always different, but the process of discovery and the urge, the curiosity and the urge for discovery is something which marks us as humans. So then all of a sudden, these computers appear. And whenever it was, 50, 60 years, I don't even know the history, but... Mm-hmm. And this thing was defined by von Neumann and Turing, a new kind of technology. So is this, 1,000 years from now, will there be writing and software? And in other words, is this joining the list of the things that make... Am I making any sense, or am I just...
You are, yes. Yeah, speech still works at this time. Computers have not destroyed it yet.
The thing that is going on a kind of computational level or an information level when you're writing, whether you're writing an essay or a piece of fiction or a computer program, is that in your head you have to have the entire thing. You've got to have the entire book or the program or whatever in some form kind of resonant in your brain, but you cannot impart it. You can't record that idea as a unified whole. Your only way of getting it out is literally one byte at a time, one letter at a time, whether you're writing it with a pen or typing it into a computer. And there's something about that process of having the whole in your brain but being forced to kind of eke it out through a soda straw that is essential to the process of writing. And I would actually say that if you literally do go back 3,000 years and look at things that people were writing, then it is fundamentally different in that a lot of it just doesn't make sense to us. So they'll have in the same story they'll tell contradictory versions of what they're trying to say on alternate lines. They'll jump around. They don't seem to have had a unified picture of the story they were trying to tell in their head at the time that they wrote it down. And one of the ways that we sort of mark the milestones en route to modern writing and modern prose is it starts to look more like what we think of as a proper story. So if you look at Homer or something, he's a hell of a lot easier to follow than, say, the Epic of Gilgamesh or certain things in the Bible. That's where I would start in trying to answer your question about the future of writing and about those mental processes that are unique to writing.
I have a little theory about why so much ancient writing is hard to read, is that I think it was sung. And if you look at lyrics, I mean, look at modern lyrics for any rock song, they don't quite make sense often. And it's so when you're singing, and if you make the music and the rhythm and the sounds a priority, you end up putting a little nonsense in order to make the rhymes work and the rhythms work and all. And since we can't really know how the languages were pronounced or how they were spoken or what the rhythms were like, it's really impossible to reconstruct that. But I think it's a good explanation for why some of these things might have been written down and come out strangely, because, I mean, people weren't writing down love letters or something because they were just too hard at that time.
Well, that definitely accounts for some things. So it's known mm-hmm. that somebody went and listened to some Croatian or poets or people up in the Balkans somewhere who did epic poetry without notes, and they would revert to certain kind of stereotyped phrases that they would repeat over and over again. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in Homer. When he's describing how they do a sacrifice, the same language comes up over and over. But I'm talking about other things where the narrative flatly contradicts itself.
Well, can you imagine somebody in 1,000 years like looking at a Bob Dylan lyric or a rap lyric or something and saying, man, this is like crazy. You're saying one thing here and another.
The question that I wanted to get at is, so we've just been writing software, and I'm sure many of these people in this room have written software programs. The three of us have all written software programs. Jaron, again, probably you've spent the most time coding, writing software. But, you know, in 100 years, are people going to look back on the software and say, my God, that was really primitive?
I hope so. God, it would be depressing. seriously, when I was 14 in 1974 or something, I gave my first computer science talk, and the topic of it was, it's worth putting up with this whole style of operating systems that we think of as Unix or Multics for another year, even though it's horrible. And you know, and it was just sort of justification that it's worth dealing with, even though it's only a temporary thing. And now it's like everywhere. It's become like it's become so embedded that it's probably more persistent than photons or something. Like you guys will come up with a better idea than photons, and then we'll give up the photon because we'll have a better theory. But like Unix is going to be stuck with us, you know, for 1,000 years. It's like this permanent feature of reality, and so there's this thing that there's this way that things get locked in. So hopefully something will bust that apart. It'll have to be. But can I just mention another?
I just want to ask, you know, in Snow Crash, are they running Unix?
Yeah, I didn't.
You didn't specify the operating system.
There. Yeah.
There is this really intriguing possibility, which I don't claim to understand. It's really on the edge of my abilities to consider it, but I've been thinking about it for many years, which is like what I call post-symbolic communication, that if you did have a way to compose virtual worlds very quickly, as if you were playing music or something, you could just intuitively spin out the phenomenon of a world you could experience with other people, that being able to experience spontaneous, very instantly made inventions would be an alternative to symbols, because instead of referring to things, you'd experience a thing directly. And if you go down that path, you can go to some very interesting places, but I don't know if it'll happen.
But that's what we do in the written word, in a way.
A little, but we don't have the agility that we have with symbolic language. We don't have categories and abstractions.
But,
and
yeah,
one
what,
could
what
if you...
you,
if you
sorry, what did you mean by that? That's
what I'm just saying that by telling a story, you're creating a world to appear in somebody's head. You're repurposing whatever neural machinery they've got up there for processing sensory inputs and constructing a picture of the world, the mechanisms you were referring to earlier, and you're somehow hotwiring that using language to build a fictional world in their head that can seem extremely real. It can evoke emotions. It can create fixed memories, like the one that I mentioned earlier of the guy getting the heel of his shoe cut off. It can be almost as real as things that you've experienced through your sensory apparatus.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, certainly. I think there might be this other domain that could exist as well that would be different, because you'd probe it with that little constant interactive testing I was talking about that gives you reality in the first place. But I don't know. It's at the edge of speculation for me.
So we've been having this conversation, and it's at the beginning, Neil, of your visit here. So I hope I am fascinated by the portrayals you've given of scientific communities. And I hope that after staying here for a few days, you'll have something interesting to say about our little scientific community here in this corner of the world.
And forward to it.
I think it's a shame in a way that this conversation didn't happen after you got to know us better. But we do look forward to your being here and hanging out. And we got lots of, is the word mathic? Mathic guys and girls around upstairs trying to do the best that we can to push science forward. And Jaron, you've been here before, but we welcome you back. The two of them are also in another panel. I believe it's Wednesday where they'll talk more about the future of computing or the digital world. And it's been an honor, a tremendous honor and a pleasure to discuss with you. And now we're going to open up to some questions from the floor.
Thanks.
Okay, and if people will, there's a microphone here. If people will come with questions, and I may not seem like it, but I'm mean only in this context. So please question short and to the point to any one or all of us. Let's go.
If I can start first, I have a question from our online audience. Jay from Waterloo asks, how does science gain more influence in society?
Does that imply that it needs to have more influence?
I think they just mean what sorts of things causes more influence for science in society? What sorts of changes will make that happen?
Well, I think that science went through a wave, has been through a few waves of being highly respected and highly influential when it made a difference over people's lifetimes. That is, when you could say, you know, when I was a kid, if you got an infection, you would die. But then they got penicillin, and that was a miracle drug, and, you know, everyone knows the story of the grapefruit and the mold and, you know, how penicillin was found. And so stories like that, I think, confer a whole lot of instant respectability on scientists and can make a whole generation of scientists kind of respected members of society. But then if you go long enough without a nice story like that, that can be told about the good effects of science, then people start seeing what they think of as the bad side of it.
Yeah. In other words, we have to earn the respect of our fellow citizens over and over again, properly.
Hi there. I'm not sure if it's a question for now or for later in the week, but what are your thoughts on the singularity and if it's something that we'll end up seeing and the fallout of such a thing?
I think it's a completely bogus piece of junk, but.
The singularity, for people who don't know, it does not mean the cosmological singularity that was being discussed here an hour and a half ago, which was in our past. He means the computers in 2024 getting infinitely smart and taking over and becoming human.
Taking over reality entirely and relegating us to either fuel to run them or, like the Matrix movies, that sort of thing, they take over. And I mean, it's really a new religion. I mean, the people who really adore the singularity have imbued it with all of the little qualities that traditional religions have. You have a means to an afterlife because it'll scoop up your brain, and you're supposed to prepare for it now. And it's it gives you this meaning and purpose. And it really is like the other religions, except it has fewer adherents, and you need to
There's an elect group that gets it.
Yeah, and everybody else doesn't.
Yeah.
And as far as the technical argument for why I don't think it'll happen, remember those comments about software that we had to wait 2 years for cut, copy, and paste? Just because the computers get faster doesn't mean we know how to write software for them. And the notion that they'll learn how to write software for themselves, I mean, where's the software? I mean, this trend doesn't exist. What we have, actually, this is another great example of the open versus closed thing. So, chips get faster and faster according to Moore's law, and software doesn't. And what's the difference? It's that the chip is so perfectly encapsulated that you can improve this thing within an absolutely specified boundary. So it's possible to understand it, nurture it, and make it better and better. So there's a learning curve, and that's the same thing as Moore's law. With software, we never know what the boundary is. It's like this open thing, and we can't ever quite contain it or understand it, and so therefore it doesn't experience a Moore's Law-like level of improvement. So, alas, no.
Okay, thank you. And if he's wrong, then we won't know it.
Then I'll see you all. Yeah, that's right. What do we have to lose here? I'll see you all in the Grey Goo.
Sorry.
I'd like to know how you feel about popular science as bridging the distance between real scientists and all of us who read a lot and can talk about concepts but don't really know what's happening.
Popular science, the magazine, or just...
I'm currently reading Mrs. Smolin's book, Trouble with Physics, and I can talk about concepts in string theory, but I can't talk about it in depth. I can't talk about the math because I don't understand it. So does that make me a layman? Does that make me a scientist? Should I be isolated, or should I talk to people?
That's great.
So my sense is that there needs to be an intelligent, informed conversation in all of the society about the frontiers of every aspect of culture, you know, painting, music, rock and roll, you know, physics, cosmology, biology. But there is definitely, it is also true that those with training and expertise who become part of the discipline are in a different situation than the other people. But I believe that I have a right to go and look and study and have an informed conversation about painting after some years of being involved in that without being a painter, and people without a training in physics but who do their homework have certainly the right to an informed conversation about physics.
There's a value, I think, for the scientist too. I mean, I'm speaking out of turn here, but it was your turn. To sit down and explain a scientific concept just in prose and make sense of it, I think can be a valuable exercise, you know, a lot of times for one's own understanding of a scientific concept.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. So a lot of people gain conscience of mainstream concepts in science through works of science fiction. When you are writing, it's also a creative process when you are writing. So when you guys are writing, are you aware of this responsibility almost of conveying these concepts to the larger public, or is it not something that plays a huge part in your works?
Well, we're all doing very different stuff, so maybe we should take turns. You know, on that one.
I mean, I don't write fiction, so I feel a tremendous responsibility to communicate correctly.
I'm not thinking typically about the reader when I'm writing. It's a completely solitary internal process. It's got to make sense to me. It's got to read well to me. That's the only thing I'm really conscious of.
I've tried to do a little bit of the science popularization thing. I had a column in Discover magazine for a while and that sort of thing. And I would go so far as to say it's a duty of a scientist who's capable of it to spend a little bit of time trying to communicate. It's a duty to oneself to learn how to talk about what you're doing, and it's a duty to society. I think it's a separable duty. I don't think you should confuse it with doing science, but I think it's a good thing to do a stint once in a while.
Thank you.
Do you think the Chinese or Asian cultures will take the American zeitgeist in the future for entertainment outside of anime and take over the way Americans run the entire cultural world, movie-wise and that type of thing, the influence they have?
Kind of an interesting question.
I mean, you could argue it's already happened. I mean, the influence of anime style and martial arts movies, that whole way of seeing the world has already captured the imagination, quite obviously, of major Americans, of Western filmmakers, you know, Tarantino and.
You know, the first virtual reality movie that didn't suck was probably the Matrix movies, and they were basically in the style of a Hong Kong martial arts film. So, in a sense, Chinese culture is the thing that's explaining ourselves to ourselves at this point already, in many cases.
Okay, the next question I want to introduce is Julian Barber, who has been an enormous influence on myself and my whole generation of people. Julian taught us what are the historical roots and the philosophical roots of the questions that we ask in quantum gravity and cosmology. So it's a little bit intimidating to see him standing there, but maybe the question is not for me.
First of all, as regards my and David Deutsch's influence on you, Neil, I describe myself as an apologetic many worlds because I do have a very intense feeling of my own uniqueness, and it's very hard to believe that I'm in multiple worlds. Although I can see the intellectual case for it, psychologically I live my life as unique. But David Deutsch is a messianic melder, many worlds. I would like to ask you about creativity, which hasn't been said much. Just very briefly, for me it was an incredible experience when I started writing, suddenly finding what was coming out of me, totally unexpectedly. I would get up in the morning and know basically what I would want to write, but had no idea what was going to come out of me. And I would say to myself, I wonder what I will have written by the end of the day. And for me, this is the single biggest miracle of existence, how something just wells up out of your unconscious and is there. It wasn't there before, and it is afterwards there. I wonder if both of you would say something about that. Because I think in talking of computers and technology and so forth, this might be something that is really quintessentially human, this fantastic luck we have of being able to produce something new, totally new.
So last year I did a lot of traveling, and I read Stephen King's Dark Tower series. So it's a seven-volume novel. And I think I was reading it partly as a way of making myself feel better, that there's someone out there who's written a longer book than I have. But in the introductory material to these volumes, he has fascinating things to say about his process. And he says that, and the reason I'm mentioning this, just to kind of jump to the end, is that he talks very eloquently about things I've noticed about my own life in this line of work. But he would, I think he wrote part of a chapter, set it down, came back to it something like 20 years later, and picked up with the next sentence. And if you're reading it, you can't see the dividing line. And this was a thing that just took over his mind for long periods of time. He would be working on other books, very famous, well-known books, but every so often, his mind would just kind of go into a fugue state where he would suddenly, it would be 6 months later, and there would be this huge stack of pages that he had somehow generated. It's a lot of it is really tremendous stuff. So he feels that there's something qualitatively different about how he wrote the Dark Tower series compared to how he wrote his other stuff, and that he even wrote this into his book. In the story has a kind of multiple worlds. It is a multiple worlds, parallel universes kind of story, and eventually he becomes a character in his own novel because he's explaining his ability to write this stuff by this theory that it's somehow pouring into him from another universe. He's not writing it at all. He's just a kind of senseless conduit for this information. And that may be taking it a little far, but that is how one feels at these times when everything works and you go into what Csikszentmihalyi calls the flow state. You're not conscious of the passage of time. You're not conscious of making an effort. Things are just happening, and then suddenly you wake up as if from a dream, and something's there that wasn't there before, just as you said. And it is a profoundly mysterious quintessentially human thing, but I don't know what to say about it beyond my own confusion and awe of it.
Okay, Jaron, do you want a quick comment about that, and then I think
I don't think I could add to that.
Okay. Well. Thank you. There was another question, but the questioner disappeared. So if there are no more questions, I want to thank again Neil and Jaron and give them a warm welcome to Perimeter and Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and best wishes for the next days here. Thank you.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.